Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Alrighty, I believe our guest is on the line here. Let's see.
Hello?
Mr. Dalrymple, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Nice to have you on the show. It is Theodore Dalrymple. And where are you located?
At the moment, I'm in Paris.
You're in Paris?
Yes.
Oh, man. Have some spaghetti and wine for us, will you?
Yeah, I will, yes. Especially the wine.
What's the weather like in Paris right now?
Well, overcast, but a bit humid. It's not especially nice.
Not especially nice. And what are you doing there?
Well, I am here quite a lot because my mother-in-law is here. My wife is French, so we have a little flat in Paris. And I'm writing a couple of books with French subjects. So I come quite often. Uh-huh. And we have a house in the south as well.
Uh-huh. You're a writer, you're a retired prison doctor, psychiatrist, yeah, and worked in some African countries. What did you do there?
Well, various things, but I went as a very young doctor and worked in hospitals there for a relatively short time, and I was also a doctor on a road project in Tanzania. And once I spent about 6 months crossing Africa by public transport and writing a book about Africa from the bottom up, as it were.
Really?
And in fact, the journey would now probably not be possible. It would be too dangerous. But yeah. Anyway, that's what I did. And I've been to a lot of African countries.
Yeah. When you traveled down there, were there some real challenges with the picking up this or that, or, you know?
Well, I got malaria a couple of times. I never had any dysentery or anything like that, and I never had any problems with local people at all. And in fact, everyone was extremely nice to me. And I was in very, very remote places. In those days, of course, there were no mobile phones, so you couldn't call. It was actually probably quicker to go to Europe than to telephone it. Uh-huh. I was, for about 6 months, I was completely incommunicado with anybody whom I knew at home.
Uh-huh. So where did all this interest in the New England Journal of Medicine come from? Your latest book is called False Positive. How'd you get kind of interested in this publication?
Well, I had a French nephew who was a medical student, and he had an exam to pass in how to read scientific papers, which is actually a very good idea, how to read the medical journals critically. We were never taught that, actually. And I think it's a very good idea. I don't know whether other medical schools do it. So he asked me for help with that. Mm-hmm. And so I gave him what I thought were a few rough rules. They're not absolute rules, but they're rough rules. And I thought, well, I'll read the New England Journal of Medicine a bit more carefully than I'd ever done before. Most doctors, practicing doctors, don't read journals very carefully. They read the summary of some kind of research and then the conclusion, and they trust that the conclusion follows from the summary.
Huh.
What I discovered was that in the New England Journal, much that was written was not really valid. And I was also interested in the tendency of the New England Journal in its commentary on society and things in general to be very politically correct. So there were two aspects. There was the aspect of the of the scientific doubtfulness of some of what is published there, and also then the political correctness. And one has to remember that the New England Journal, along with the Lancet, is probably the most important general medical journal in the world. So these two are the most important, and they have quite a number of similarities.
Yeah, they, of course, they are the brand names that, people quote those, and it's like the Bible. And I'm like, ooh, New England Journal of Medicine, yeah, or Lancet.
But where science is concerned, there is no Bible.
There isn't.
No. I mean, because everything, well, at least most things, are questionable, and interpretations of results are not certain, and methods are not certain. So there's a constant revision. In other words, one shouldn't regard anything as being wholly writ.
Yeah. Is it? It must be difficult to really discern the impact of financing for different things that go on with that are reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the bias that may be there before they even write an article.
Yes, I mean, it's very difficult. I can't.
How would you know? Right? Yeah. How would you know?
I can't misattribute motives or anything like that. And in addition, I don't want to give the impression that nothing whatever of value is written in the New England Journal or the Lancet. Of course, that wouldn't be true. I mean, that would be a gross exaggeration. Nevertheless, its former editor, Marcia Angel, said that after 20 years of editing it, it took her obviously a long time for the penny to drop, she came to the conclusion that she couldn't trust almost any of the research that's published in the journals. I think that's an exaggeration too. But anyway, I'm not alone in my skepticism.
But she said that.
Yes, she said that. She said that in the New York Review of Books, I think.
Very interesting. Now, you're a scientist, psychiatrist, doctor. When you read the New England Journal of Medicine, I mean, you start to find things. I mean, how would you even know? I'm kind of curious. How would you even know that there's something rotten in Denmark, so to speak?
Well, you have to read things very carefully,
and who does that?
And that's
right?
Something
nobody
which
does
we
that.
Very rarely do.
Right, nobody does that.
No, well,
I mean, you do. Maybe.
Say nobody does it, but unless you have a special reason to read a paper, you don't read it from beginning to end. And even if you do, you actually have to look at the tables of results to check. So that, for example, I've forgotten exactly which paper it was. You know, I wrote this book. Maybe a year ago, and I've written two since. My memory is not perfect. But there was one paper where they were comparing one drug, a new drug, with another drug, and they failed to refer to the fact that more people had died on the new drug than on the old. Now, the difference may not have been statistically significant. It might have been a chance finding. But what was interesting is that they didn't even refer to it in the text. They didn't even refer to it in the text to say that this was of no importance. They just ignored it completely. Now, unless you had gone down with your finger, more or less, line by line in the table, you wouldn't have noticed that.
Yes. Wow. Well, that's significant.
Well, I think it is. I mean, it's called death quite a bad side effect. And if it was a side effect, maybe it wasn't a side effect, but you want to know that it isn't, or you should want to know that it isn't.
Yeah. What would be some of the top papers that you found to be false positive that may relate to our listeners and something that they may be doing or a medicine they're taking?
Well, the kind of problem that there is, let me give you one kind of problem.
Okay.
Often papers are one thing that's very clear in the journal is that the papers are often statistically exceedingly complex, and I shouldn't think one doctor in a thousand understands the statistics. And the statistics, if given to a different set of statisticians, will yield a different result. Nevertheless, what often happens is that I'll give you a fictional example. Someone wants to show that eating hazelnuts is a cause of flat feet. And so what they do is they examine the history of hazelnut eating in, shall we say, 5 million people. And come to the conclusion that the top 10% of hazelnut eaters have a risk 1.2 times as great of having flat feet as people in the lowest hazelnut consumption, from which it's always concluded that eating hazelnuts gives you flat feet. And that's the kind of article that is more and more common in the New England Journal and in The Lancet and every other journal. And, of course, no one actually tells you what your chances of having flat feet in the first place are. So that even if you have an increased risk of something, what you really want to know is what the absolute risk is. Because if the absolute risk is trivial, then doubling it isn't going to make it important. And often in papers, you have to work out for yourself the absolute risk. And if you have to work out the absolute risk for yourself, you can be more or less sure that the whole thing is trivial, because if it were not trivial, it would be trumpeted all over the place.
Boy, that's fascinating.
So that's one thing to look out for.
You found that a lot?
Quite a lot, yes.
Wow.
Yes. And another thing, for example, if you take screening procedures, the one is for, I don't know your age, but one interesting one is screening for cancer of the prostate. Now, this is an extremely complicated question.
Yeah.
And there was a paper about it. It wasn't a particularly bad paper, but it just gave you the death rate from cancer of the prostate following following screening. What it didn't do is give you the all-cause death rate, so that unless you're particularly interested in not dying of cancer of the prostate but would rather die of something else, it may well be that your life expectancy is not increased by a reduction in the rate of death from prostate cancer, especially in view of the fact that after the age of about 85, I've forgotten what the percentage is, but I think it's more than half, of men have cancer of the prostate in situ, but it's indolent. So there's that kind of problem as well. And I'm not sure that that people understand this. And in fact, it's extremely difficult to understand. It's very difficult to work out whether a screening procedure like taking a blood test for prostate enlargement and cancer is of any value.
Yeah, more people have been saying that, Mr. Dalrymple, around in the natural world, that the PSA test is relatively just meaningless. So after reading these papers on the prostate, do you suspect that could be true, possibly be true?
Oh, yes, I think, and what it's worse than that, it could actually be harmful.
How could it be harmful?
Because, you see, if you, supposing you have a test.
Yeah.
And it proves positive.
Yes.
Then there are all kinds of things that get done to you after that.
That's right. They start cutting on you as one, right? They want to do
now,
a biopsy.
Now, fortunately, even today with techniques which are much better than they used to be, there are serious side effects from like incontinence and so on. So, and the problem is that a very large percentage of positive results probably don't mean a lot anyway, because the rate of progression of prostate cancer is very variable. It does, it can kill you, of course. That is true. I've had friends who've died of it.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it may just continue for years and years. And then there's the question of whether it's worth having 10 years of impotence, shall we say,
sure.
Incontinence, yeah. For a 10% chance of having your life extended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is no firm answer to that.
We've often.
Now, I don't believe that many ordinary patients understand the difficulties of all this.
Yeah, and there's no way to know for sure, but can we conjecture that there's a lot of doctors that don't really explain it like you did?
I think that must be true. I mean, apart from everything else, they don't have the time to. And when you consider that this isn't the only thing they've got to explain, they've got to try to explain to patients all kinds of things, like the logic on which they are taking tablets for high blood pressure.
Yeah, yeah. And
I think most people, when they take tablets, think that they're going to do them good. But that isn't true.
It isn't true. Whoops.
No, it's not true.
You got another one.
Because if you take high blood pressure, for example, it's true that if it prevents a stroke or a heart attack in 10 years' time, it's done you a lot of good. But unfortunately, there's no method of knowing whether you are the person who's going to have the heart attack out of, shall we say, if you give the drug to 100 people, it will save one from having a stroke or a heart attack. But there's no way of knowing which of those 100 people it's going to be. So in other words, 100 people have to take this drug in order for there to be this benefit. Now, all drugs have side effects. So some people will have side effects without having their lives saved. And in any case, what one finds is that, and this is another very difficult question, most people don't take their tablets as prescribed. But after a year, people who are on high blood pressure tablets, half of them have given up.
Hmm.
Now, when you analyze the results, do you take what the drug is intended to do for people if they take the drug correctly, or do you take what actually happens in practice when you inform the patient about the benefit of taking the drug? I might be wrong, I don't know, but I would very much doubt whether many patients are aware of these difficulties. And in fact, I can understand why not. They want to be told what I think. Most people want to be told what to do.
Yes.
You don't want to have to go to the doctor and be left with a decision which is extremely difficult. I had a patient where I described all these difficulties. He was mildly hypertensive. He was actually in a prison. And I gave him all the facts and figures as I understood them, which might, of course, be wrong, because everyone's understanding is slightly different. And then I said, do you want to take the tablets or not? And he wasn't a very clever man, but he said, well, I don't know, you're the doctor. and he said, what do you think? And I think that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. After all, you don't go to a lawyer obviously he consults you with about what you do, but finally you want a lawyer whose advice you can take.
So surely, though, there would be some accurate, long-standing stats that say the people with hypertension and they take high blood pressure medicine live longer.
There are, but I mean, it's taken an incredibly long time. And even today, people don't absolutely agree over these things. It's the same is true with, you would think, with mammography.
Yeah, right.
People don't agree over the statistics or the interpretation of the statistics. And furthermore, at the heart of the problem is the unanswerable question of whether it is worthwhile for someone to take a drug for 5 years on a 1% chance that it's going to prevent something.
Yeah.
That's not a question that can be answered yes or no. You might think it's worth it. I might think it's not worth it.
Yes, I understand. Well, more and more evidence, I think, that we find in the natural world, Doctor, is that the less people mess with cancer, the longer they live.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't go as far as that.
Well,
I
maybe mean, not. I mean, but
so I think that.
But
I
you mean, know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying.
I do actually quote, for example, in the book, which I hope is not entirely unfair. It's not just a rant. I hope. I quote, for example, a friend of mine whose life expectancy has been greatly increased by a new drug for chronic leukemia, and who should have been dead according to old statistics quite a long time ago, and is in fact pretty well for someone of 85. So I don't want to deny that there's been huge progress in many fields, and that progress still occurs and can occur. But there has to be a warning that sometimes it's less than people expect.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I understand. And I think I believe that there are lots of new, very pointed, particular chemo drugs that are doing some, that if people choose to go that route, which many people don't, but if people do, we're hearing more and more people that are having pretty good results with them. And some of these remember 20, 30 years ago, they were just carpet bombing with chemo, right? Because they didn't know what it was, you know. And and those people, God love them, you know, they've merely made it out alive just with the chemo. Yeah.
Yes, well, I mean, they made death preferable. But, I mean, it's not just there. One particular example that I'm fond of is the treatment of peptic ulcer.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in that because my father suffered from it for years, and our whole house smelled of food cooked in milk, and he took all kinds of licorice supplements and aluminium hydroxide with peppermint in it, and he had two operations, one of which very nearly killed him, and it still didn't cure him.
It didn't cure it. Okay, so let's stop there and tease the people. I have to do a little commercial break, and then we'll get back to peptic ulcer, and we add aluminum and milk and buttermilk and cabbage juice that didn't work, and we'll find out what to hit. Okay, stay there. Previously with Peter Ragnar, who's a great example of staying young and healthy, we asked him what kinds of things he takes.
Personally, for myself, I look at all of the supplements that help bolster and harmonize my hormones. And, you know, this is both for men and for women. And when you go online, there's so much information about that out there. I heard on one of your advertisements there, Patrick, about the pine pollen. I personally take pine pollen, which I think it's an amazing product, has an amazing effect upon the body.
Peter, it's one of our favorites, too. Pine pollen, any of these are Thrival links. You have the pine pollen pure potency, pine pollen gold, and if you'd like to get it every month, the auto ship is the best price. Also, Stephen Buhner's book, exclusively on pine pollen, is right there on the site too, Daniel's site, right here on OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with Dr. Ross Stewart, who just kind of came up with this, telling about how he works with people and their neurotransmitters.
How do we produce sufficient amounts of glutathione in the liver, which, of course, is a big filter for all the blood, pulling half-spent hormones, waste, dead cells, and other toxins out of the blood? The higher the level of glutathione, the longer a person is going to live and the better their blood is. And I'm glad you're doing a sulfur product. Once you start getting any of these kinds of symptoms, all the way from autism, all the way through Parkinson's, you can't get enough sulfur from eating broccoli and kale and cauliflower and garlic and onions. You can't get enough. You need to supplement it.
Well, the information just keeps on coming with sulfur. The sulfur that we promote is 99.97% pure, no additives, no excipients. Just click an order on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Well, there's just so many good things going on with sulfur. I mean, the more you read about it, you can just Google it if you want. If you'd like to learn more, or go on Mercola or someplace and just put in the benefits of taking sulfur. And really, really, it's a great product. And it's not going to hurt you. And it helps you to sleep. It helps you to sleep more deeply so you remember more of your dreams. And there, I mean, if it, just that benefit alone would be worth the price of admission, in my opinion. But nobody listens to me. This is a great product. It's pure. Now, if you go on Amazon or our places, everybody goes, and you buy sulfur MSM, you can find some MSM or sulfur that are just, my goodness, half the price, really. But it's not the same. They have excipients in there. They have silicone dioxide, which we find out that doesn't like it. Sulfur is very persnickety. It's kind of a real picky kind of a thing. It's just like a very, well, it's just like most women. They really know what they want. And when they, you know what I'm saying? When they're, you know, they say, no, I don't want that. Sulfur does that. And that's why, one of the reasons, in my opinion, why sulfur is getting so slammed around with the glyphosates in the GMOs, because it's just, it's not happy. And it screws up the sulfur cycle with these GMOs. And that's another reason why you might want to take some. But increases the glycine kind of thing and the glutathione in the liver, helps the body detoxify. This great product. We have 2 1-pound containers of pure sulfur for you. Just click an order on oneradionetwork.com. If you like more than 4 pounds, email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Previously with Andrew Goss, I asked him why would someone want to buy coins from his company?
So if you don't know coins, you better know your coin dealer. And, you know, you shouldn't buy coins from someone who isn't well-known registered dealer. So if they're an NGC dealer, they're registered with NGC. If they're a PCGS dealer, they're registered with PCGS. Ask questions. Don't just, oh, yeah, here's 10 grand or 50 grand or 150 grand. I just want to buy coins, you know, let me know what I'm getting. And no, that's not how an intelligent investor does it. And we do not let you do that. So if you're not willing to learn about the coins that you're buying, maybe you should find another coin firm. Don't call this one, because we're going to insist that you know why and how a coin is rare. And once you know that, then I think you can take that knowledge into the marketplace and make intelligent investment decisions.
Aha, what a concept, intelligent investment decisions. I've known Andrew for 25 years. He's the real deal. His company, STL 800-468-2646. Give him a call if you're interested. 800-468-2646.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
All right. We're talking with an interesting gentleman indeed. His name is Dr. Theodore Dalrymple. And his one of the books we're talking about is False Positives and some of the research that he's done with the New England Journal of Medicine and the Lancet. And yeah, so what do you know about H. pylori? Because peptic ulcer, there's been so much talked about it in the last 10 years. Well, H. pylori, everybody's got it, and you can get an ulcer without it or with it. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, I mean, the thing that I wanted to say was that when I first read in the Lancet, actually, right, the papers by two Australian researchers saying that it was the cause of peptic ulceration. Not all peptic ulceration. You can have peptic ulceration without the infection, but there was H. pylori. I read it with great skepticism, as did, I think, probably most doctors, because until then, we thought that it was the causation was what we call multifactorial, which is really a kind of dustbin type of explanation. You know, type A personality, the hard driving personality, tobacco, diet, and all that kind of thing, bit of genetics thrown in. And in fact, Barry Marshall, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, actually took a culture of H. pylori in order to show it. And he himself suffered a few days afterwards from gastritis and then peptic ulceration, and eliminated it with antibiotics.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, my father, after many, many years, took some antibiotics, and he never was bothered again by it until he died.
Really? Really?
So this is this was remarkable research published in The Lancet. So I, as I said, I don't want to say that journals have absolutely nothing of any value. That would be ridiculous.
Right, right, right. So with your research, the H. pylori can be kicked out with a antibiotic. Do you know which one worked for your dad?
Well, you use triple antibiotics. You don't use just one. And I don't know the latest recommendation, but you use more than one antibiotic. Ampicillin and metronidazole used to be two. But I'm a bit out of touch with what actually is used now because I've been out of practice for quite a number of years, and it evolves. But anyway, that is a remarkable change, because when I was a student, an enormous proportion of the surgery done, gastrointestinal surgery, was for ulceration, peptic ulceration. Yeah. And now practically, well, I wouldn't say none, but very, very little is done for it. So it has changed things out of all recognition as far as peptic ulceration is concerned. And when you think, I mean, my father used to have to get up in the middle of the night and pace it, because it was particularly bad at night. Duodenal ulcer pain is particularly bad at night, and people, he used to pace up and down and so on. It was awful.
Yeah, boy. It obviously there are times when antibiotics just work. You know.
Well, they do. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we don't recommend them because we're natural kind of folks, but there are cases in pneumonia and like this. Yeah. Maybe it's just time to nuke them and be done with it.
Yes.
Right? Well, you can.
But anyway, this was most remarkable research. You'd be interested that this was not the first time a researcher had swallowed causative bacteria. A man called Pettenkofer wanted to, back in the 1890s, wanted to disprove Koch's theory that cholera was caused by the Vibrio cholerae. And so in front of a whole load of students, he took an infusion of Vibrio cholerae, the germ of cholera, drank it, and was perfectly all right.
Really?
And from this he concluded that Koch was wrong. But of course, what he didn't recognize was the difference between a necessary and a sufficient condition.
Mm-hmm.
So that it wasn't a sufficient condition of getting cholera that you had the cholera germ, but it was a necessary condition.
Dr. Retired British psychiatrist Theodore Dalrymple is with us, and we're talking about his book he wrote last year about false positives. About the New England Journal of Medicine, called False Positives, and Lancet. What are some of the other things before we go that you found significant that our listeners worldwide might find interesting with some of the false positives in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Well, there was a paper from Denmark trying to establish that if you put defibrillators everywhere and train the whole population in cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Oh yeah, I remember that movement. Yeah, that did go out there, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in a country like Denmark, they can put this into action. Apart from anything else, the medical records of everyone in Denmark, the entire population, are centralized, so that if you go to one doctor whom you've never seen before, he can just find your medical records.
Oh, good.
Well, it's very good, but it is slightly creepy as well.
Yes, I was being facetious there with "oh, good." Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, no, I mean, from a doctor's point of view, it's very frustrating if you don't have a person's medical records, and it leads to gross over-treatment and over-investigation, because often things have been done before and diagnoses have already been excluded or proved or whatever.
Sure.
Or treatments tried and so on. So it is, I mean, from the purely medical point of view, it's a good thing. It's just socially slightly creepy. Anyway, they trained everyone to do cardiopulmonary massage. And what this paper tried to show was that as a result of this survival of people having cardiac arrests outside hospital had gone up. And it seemed to me that this was, they tried to prove this, in my view, in an almost crooked way by choosing the data which they started their statistics and the data which they ended them. Uh-huh. Because if they'd chosen different starting dates and different ending dates, they might have come to the opposite conclusion. This paper resembled more like the advice you get from a financial advisor, who with his graphs can always show you how wonderfully he's doing, by selecting the scale and so on and so forth, than real scientific research. And so what they were doing was actually propagandizing, if you like, for something that they believed in. At least this was how I read the paper. And I think I doubt that this is very, very uncommon.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you just said, that you could just pick certain dates and who would know, right? And then you're going to get a result that you want.
Yes, well, that's in essence what I thought that these people had done. Of course, there are some times when you can't do that, but that was certainly the case in this paper. And it's not insignificant, because if what you're trying to do is convert the entire world to cardiopulmonary resuscitation and putting these machines absolutely everywhere, then it has consequences, financial amongst others. Mm. Another thing, of course, that it showed was that a fairly high percentage of people who undergo cardiopulmonary hypertension actually lead pretty rotten lives after they've been resuscitated. Mm-hmm. And then there's the impossible question arises as to how many real successes counter all the harm that is done. Again, there's no, I don't think there's any indubitable answer you could give to that question.
Yeah. One of the classic ones that gets most talked about on the natural world, doctor, is the use of statins to lower cholesterol, which we have known for 20 years is that cholesterol is not a problem. It's actually, you want to have a nice high cholesterol level. I try to keep mine 200 or 225. You know, that's my goal. But that's just me. Dave, do you have any comments on that with the New England Journal of Medicine or Lancet?
In this particular year that I looked at, there wasn't much that I saw about statins, but I have a friend who's a great expert in this, and the doctrine, as far as I can tell, keeps changing. As far as I understand it, statins this is what he says, and of course I take him as an authority, he's a professor, are indicated if you have, for secondary prevention, that is prevention if you have had a stroke or a heart attack. But to prevent having a heart attack or a stroke in the first place, they're pretty nearly useless. But there's a large movement to place almost everybody over the age of 50.
Yes.
On statins. I mean, they might as well put it in the water. And I'm extremely skeptical about that.
Yeah. Well, it's a curious world out there. Before we go, you talked about professors, and I know there's a tremendous amount of research and different studies, quote unquote, that are done in this country from universities. Like if you want to prove something, the government can give grants to universities and say, you know, let us know, you know, that this is, you know what I'm saying. It happens all the time. Is that a worldwide kind of phenomenon thing with universities being given grants and being paid to come up with certain conclusions?
Well, I mean, I hesitate to impugn people's motives. I mean, I know as an expert witness, there is a tendency when you are employed by one side or the other, the defense or the prosecution, to find arguments for what your employers would like you to find.
Yes.
And that's a kind of natural human tendency. I mean, it, however hard you struggle against it, it happens. I think actually that in some respects things have improved greatly as far as trials anyway are concerned, in that it's no longer possible to suppress the results of trials if you don't like the results. Because it's been realized that if you, for example, don't publish negative results, then if you publish only positive results, then you get a false idea of the effectiveness of drugs. This is particularly so in the case of antidepressants, for example. And that seems to have got better. And one of the things that I thought was better about the New England Journal was that it was more prepared to publish negative results. At one time, you would never see negative results. I mean, to see a trial in which you found that something didn't work was very rare.
Uh-huh.
And now it's not very rare. And I think that that's actually a very good thing. But I was so anyway. Trials now have to be registered, and you can't was once the way, change the goal of the trial. When you find that it doesn't work in one way, then what you do is you just change the goal, and so you always come up with some kind of success.
Yes.
And that's no longer possible. But the number of trials that are registered astonished me. They're in the hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're a psychiatrist, right? And so you understand, and then also as being in all fields of medicine, you understand the power that happens when people worry or have angst. We can create anything, right? We can create cancer and IBS, whatever you want to create by just thinking. I mean, you can just do it. So I was always been curious about studies, doctor, when they don't really put into these studies, how do they know what these people are thinking or what these people are eating or if they're, I mean, how can studies even be close to being accurate, not having their diet or maybe there's, I mean, how would you know, you can't tell.
Well, there are studies that try to control for things, but of course you can't control for everything. One of the things that I point out, I mean, it's not an original thought, I'm not an original thinker, is that if, for example, you trawl through data, if you want to, I saw a paper, I think it was in the JAMA recently, where it seemed to me that what the people had done is trawled through a lot of data and then found that something was associated with something else. Now, if you... And it appeared to be not by chance, statistically.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now, the fact is that if you examine enough variables, you will always find some that appear to be associated with whatever it is you're interested in. So if, for example, let's take an illness. Let's take, an illness that I have myself, gout.
Uh-huh.
If you examined... shall we say, 1,000 variables, you are bound to find some that appear to be associated with gout, not by chance, which actually are associated with it by chance. So the correct procedure is to have an hypothesis that this is a cause of gout, shall we say, and then look at it, not just trawl through a whole load of data. And unfortunately, it's not possible to say often from papers whether this is something that has been done or not. Whether they really started with an hypothesis or whether they were just trying to find something.
Yeah.
And if you look hard enough, you'll always find something.
Well, there must have been plenty going on that was kind of cooking the books in some ways with the New England Journal of Medicine. If you wrote an entire book on it, there must have been a lot of stuff.
Yes, I mean, again, cooking the books implies
okay, probably not a good term. Probably not.
Conscious dishonesty, yeah. And you know, there's a lot about financial incentives, you know, to find things. And I was slightly alarmed when I saw papers which had been written with the aid of companies, and the data had been analysed by the companies, sure. And so on. So that seems to me dangerous. But of course, there are other causes of people to be slightly. Well, I won't say dishonest, but should we say inclined to favor their own views. If you've spent your life investigating something and you have a fairly firm hypothesis, you are very reluctant to let it go. And so you will tend to put the best gloss on it possible. I think that's just human nature.
Yeah.
I have lots of views about things. And if someone were to come along with data which showed my views to be incorrect, I would be extremely unwilling to give up my views.
Yeah.
And therefore, I would find all kinds of excuses not to give up my views. I think this is human nature.
As you
know, I wouldn't exclude myself from it.
I don't know how it is in Europe, but as you know, in this country, I don't have a TV, but I've seen my share that the television is filled with ads for pharmaceutical medicines, as you know. Is it that the way in Europe?
No. In Europe, we don't have.
You don't have that, really?
Problem. No. Huh? I mean, there are, of course, over-the-counter.
But not the pharmaceuticals, really?
But you don't have advertisements for pharmaceuticals, no. I mean, of course, advertisements are they're pharmaceuticals are advertised to doctors, of course.
Sure, yeah. I guess what I was just going
to not to the general.
Not
public.
To the general. I was just going to ask. I was going to get your opinion about how in this country, then they have to give all of the side effects. I guess the FDA made them do that, and sometimes they'll run for 20 seconds, telling people all these weird things that can happen to you if you take it. Possibly, you know. And it's amazing that people take these drugs. And
you have to. This again is very difficult. I mean, puts a lot of onus on the patient. Yeah. If you get a list of
side effects, right?
Potential,
yeah.
Some of them are relatively common, and others are rare.
Yeah.
And the person has to decide for himself, can get terribly anxious about it, then has to decide for himself whether the light is worth the candle. Alternatively,
right.
He can ignore it altogether.
Sure.
So he can either dither for days
or
just take it. In the prison in which I work, for example, prisoners, I think this is universal in prison, if prisoners find tablets somewhere, they just take them without even inquiring what they are for.
Really?
Because what they're hoping is that it will have some kind of psychological, psychoactive effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if they're told that it's an unpleasant psychoactive effect, they would still take them because actually what they want is change. They don't want betterment. They don't want to feel better. They want to feel different.
Different from what they do, yeah. Wow.
They do. So, I mean, sometimes I used to think in the prison the only people who didn't take anticonvulsants were the people who suffered from epilepsy. And they used to leave them about, and the other prisoners would just take them.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the hope of getting out to hospital.
Is the overuse of opiates a big deal over in Europe as it is here in this country?
No, today? Much less.
Is
much
it less? Really?
That is a real scandal, of course.
Yes, it is, sir. Yeah.
And
why do you suppose? Why do you suppose it's
levels.
Less in Europe? Why do you think it's less?
Well, I think they've been partly marketed less. I think now, of course, the problem is that many of the opioids are illicit. I mean, it started in America with licit opioids. Mm-hmm. The doctors started prescribing them. This was a very interesting case of misinterpretation of what was written in a medical journal, in the New England Journal, in fact. There was a short letter in 1980 by a man called Jick saying something which was true, namely that patients who go into hospital with acute pain, shall we say, from a heart attack or whatever, and are given opiates, strong opiates, don't become addicted to them. And that is true. From which, unfortunately, it was concluded and propagandized that if those patients didn't get addicted, then you could just give opiates to any opioids to anybody who complained of pain and they wouldn't get addicted. And this was gross. Well, how could I? I must be temperate. I say this is a gross misinterpretation of the original statement.
I see.
And unfortunately, it's led to the situation that we have now. And I sincerely hope that people in Europe have learned from the American experience. Unfortunately, as I said, now drugs like fentanyl are coming in illicitly, manufactured largely in China, and the medical profession or anybody else seems to have any means of controlling it.
Yeah, you know, it just pours in anywhere they can pour it in. Well, yeah, doctor, you're an interesting fellow to talk to. Thanks for your time. What are your latest two books about?
Well, the first one, Paris is the best place in the world for cinema. You find films from everywhere in the world. And so I decided to do a journey around the world in Parisian cinemas, never having to leave Parisian cinemas, and I could go around the world. And to me, it was very interesting to see films from places where you wouldn't think films ever emerged from.
Oh, that's a fun job. That's a fun job.
Yeah, that's the first thing. And the other thing is that I live, when I'm in Paris, near a famous cemetery called the Père Lachaise, in which people like Balzac and Oscar Wilde are buried. And it occurred to me that if very famous writers are buried in Père Lachaise, then there must be many writers who are not famous who are buried in Père Lachaise, and they are forgotten. So I'm going to do a book about the forgotten writers of Père Lachaise, and they're not necessarily forgotten because they were not good or they were not interesting. It's just because 99.99% of writers, like myself, are forgotten even before their death, let alone after
That's
their death.
That's right. I understand. That's great. Well, you're fun to talk to. I appreciate your time. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, have a nice evening in Paris.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. Dr. Theodore Dalrymple. That's fun talking to people around the world, isn't it? Nice. I like it. All right, kids, I will see you tomorrow, and we're going to do open phones. We have lots to talk about. I'm going to give you my own little H. pylori update on my MG. Yeah, got one of those little guys. I don't even know if I got it. Who knows? These days, boy, you know, you just wake up and you put one foot in front of another and do it again. I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support. Appreciate your looking at our website. Please go on our website and look at some of the products that we have there. And that's how we make our living. So if you see something you like, you can be sure that we know them. We know the people. We've been working with them for a long time. You know, some more than others. But I think the newest one is Pearl Sim. It's been about 6 months, but people really love this product. But I guess Wayne, 8 months or so, and then the other ones, all the rebounder and the sauna. Daniel Vitalis and Shen Blossom for a long, long time. The good people and so forth. So if you see anything that tickles your fancy, give it a buy, give it a whirl, and we appreciate your support. So I'll see you tomorrow. May the blessings be.
From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.